Chapter 26. And near canary bird, and near milliners, and turn rusty, because he forgets your last message. I did not turn rusty, Frank, as you call it elegantly. I'm very much obliged to Mr. Butts for performing my commissions, very much obliged. And as for not paying for the pictures to which you so kindly allude, Frank, I should never have thought of offering payment for so paltry a service. But I'm sure I shall be happy to pay, if Mr. Butts will send me in his bill. By Jove, Angelica, this is too much. Bounced out Barry, but the little matrimonial squabble was abruptly ended by Barry's Frenchman flinging open the door and announcing Milady Pash and Dr. Dobus, with two personages made their appearance. The person of old Pash has been already parenthetically described. But quite different from her dismal niece in temperament, she is as jolly an old widow as ever wore weeds. She was attached somehow to the court, and has a multiplicity of stories about the princesses and the old king, to which Mrs. Barry never fails to call your attention in her grave, important way. Lady Pash has ridden many a time to the Windsor hounds. She made her husband become a member of the Foreign Hand Club, and has numberless stories about Sir Godfrey Webster, Sir John Lade, and the old heroes of those times. S. He has lent a rouleau to Dick Sheridan, and remembers Lord Byron, when he was a sulky slim young lad. She says Charles Fox was the pleasantest fellow she ever met with, and has not the slightest objection to inform you that one of the princes was very much in love with her. Yet somehow she is only 52 years old, and I have never been able to understand her calculation. One day or other before her I went out, and before those pearly teeth of hers were stuck to her gums by gold, she must have been a pretty looking body enough. Yet, in spite of the latter inconvenience, she eats and drinks too much every day, and tosses off a glass of maraschino with a trembling pudgy hand, every finger of which twinkles with a dozen, at least, of old rings. S. He has a story about every one of those rings, and a stupid one too. But there is always something pleasant, I think, in stupid family stories. They are good-hearted people who tell them. As for Mrs. Mutchett, nothing need be said of her. She is Pash's companion. S. He has lived with Lady Pash since the peace. Nor does my lady take any more notice of her than of the dust of the earth. She calls her Ur Mutchett, and considers her a half-witted creature. Mrs. Barry hates her cordially, and thinks she is a designing toad-eater, who has formed a conspiracy to rob her of her aunt's fortune. She never spoke a word to poor Mutchett during the whole of dinner, or offered to help her to anything on the table. In respect to Dobus, he is an old peninsular man, as you are made to know before you have been very long in his company, and, like most army surgeons, is a great deal more military in his looks and conversation than the combatant part of the forces. He has adopted the sham Duke of Wellington air, which is by no means uncommon in veterans, and, though one of the easiest and softest fellows in existence, speaks slowly and briefly, and raps out an oath or two occasionally, as it is said a certain great captain does. Besides the above, we sat down to table with Captain Goff, late of the Highlanders, the Reverend Lemuel Way, who preaches at St. Germain's, Little Cutler, and the Frenchman, who always will be at English parties on the continent, and who, after making some frightful efforts to speak English, subsides and is heard no more. Young married ladies and heads of families generally have him for the purpose of waltzing, and in return he informs his friends of the club or the café that he has made the conquest of a charming Angliss. Listen to me, all family men who read this, and never let an unmarried Frenchman into your doors. This lecture alone is worth the price of the book. It is not that they do any harm in one case out of a thousand, heaven forbid, but they mean harm. They look on our Susannas with unholy dishonest eyes. Here can two of the grinning rogues chattering together as they clink over the asphalt of the boulevard with lacquered boots, and plastered hair, and waxed mustaches, and turned down shirt collars, and stays and goggling eyes, and hear how they talk of a good simple giddy vain dull Baker Street creature, and canvass her points, and show her letters, and insinuate never mind, but I tell you my soul grows angry when I think of the same. And I can't hear of an Englishwoman marrying a Frenchman without feeling a sort of shame and pity for her. 4. To return to the guests. The Reverend Lemuel Way is a tea party man, with a curl on his forehead and a scented pocket handkerchief. He ties his white neckcloth to a wonder, and I believe sleeps in it. He brings his flute with him, and prefers Handel, of course. But has one or two pet profane songs of the sentimental kind, and will occasionally lift up his little pipe in a glee. He does not dance, but the honest fellow would give the world to do it, and he leaves his clogs in the passage, though it is a wonder he wears them, for in the muddiest weather he never has a speck on his foot. He was at St. John's College, Cambridge, and was rather gay for a term or two, he says. He is, in a word, full of the milk and water of human kindness, and his family lives near Hackney. As for Gough, he has a huge shining bald forehead, and immense bristling Indian red whiskers. He wears whitewash leather gloves, drinks fairly, likes a rubber, and has a story for after dinner, beginning, Dr. Eraclick Sandy Mlellan, who joined us in the West Indies. Wall, sir, etc. These and little Cutler made up the party. Now it may not have struck all readers, but any sharp fellow conversant with writing must have found out long ago, that if there had been something exceedingly interesting to narrate with regard to this dinner at Frank Berry's, I should have come out with it a couple of pages since, nor have kept the public looking for so long a time at the dish covers and ornaments of the table. But the simple fact must now be told, that there was nothing of the slightest importance occurred at this repast, except that it gave me an opportunity of studying Mrs. Berry in many different ways, and, in spite of the extreme complaisance which she now showed me, of forming, I am sorry to say, a most unfavorable opinion of that fair lady. Truth to tell, I would much rather she should have been civil to Mrs. Mutchett than outrageously complimentary to your humble servant, and as she professed not to know what on earth there was for dinner, would it not have been much more natural for her not to frown, and bob, and wink, and point, and pinch her lips as often as Monsieur Anatole, her French domestic, not knowing the ways of English dinner tables, placed anything out of its due order? The allusions to Bootle Hall were innumerable, and I don't know any greater bore than to be obliged to talk of a place which belongs to one's elder brother. Many questions were likewise asked about the Dowager and her Scotch relatives, the Plumduffs, about whom Lady Pash knew a great deal, having seen them at court, and at Lord Melville's. Of course, as he had seen them at court, and at Lord Melville's, as she might have seen thousands of Scotchmen besides. But what mattered it to me, who care not a jot for old Lady Fitzboodle? Henny Wright, you'll say you met an old friend of her ladyship's, says Mrs. Berry, and I faithfully promised I would when I wrote. But if the new post office paid us for writing letters, as very possibly it will soon, I could not be bribed to send a line to old Lady Fitz. In a word, I found that Berry, like many simple fellows before him, had made choice of an imperious, ill-humored, and underbred female for a wife, and could see with half an eye that he was a great deal too much her slave. The struggle was not over yet, however. Witness that little encounter before dinner, and once or twice the honest fellow replied rather smartly during the repast, taking especial care to atone as much as possible for his wife's inattention to Jack and Mrs. Mutchett, by particular attention to those personages, whom he helped to everything round about and pressed perpetually to champagne. He drank but little himself, for his amiable wife's eye was constantly fixed on him. Just at the conclusion of the dessert, Madame, who had bowed Barry during dinner time, became particularly gracious to her lord and master, and tenderly asked me if I did not think the French custom was a good one, of men leaving table with the ladies. Upon my word, ma'am, says I think it's a most abominable practice. And so do I, says Cutler. A most abominable practice. Do you hear that? Cries Barry, laughing, and filling his glass. I'm sure, Frank, when we are alone you always come to the drawing room, replies the lady, sharply. Oh, yes. When we're alone, darling, says Barry, blushing. But now we're not alone, ha, ha. Anatole, du Bordeaux. I'm sure they sat after the ladies at Carlton House, didn't they, Lady Pash? Says Dobus, who likes his glass. That they did, says my lady, giving him a jolly nod. I racklicked, exclaims Captain Goff, when I was in the Mauritius, that Mistress McWhirter, who commanded the 62nd, used to say, Mac, if ye want to get lively, ye'll not stop for more than 2 hours after the ladies have left ye. If ye want to get drunk, ye'll just dine at the mass. ... So ye see, Mistress Barry, what was Mac's allowance, ha, ha. Mr. Way, I'll trouble ye for the o lives. But although we were in a clear majority, that indomitable woman, Mrs. Barry, determined to make us all as uneasy as possible, and would take the votes all round. Poor Jack, of course, sided with her, and Way said he loved a cup of tea, and a little music better than all the wine of Bordeaux. As for the Frenchman, when Mrs. Barry said, and what do you think, M. le Vicomte? That you speak? Said M. de Blagwivel, breaking silence for the first time during 2 hours. Et say? To me you speak? Après dîner, aimez-vous aller avec les dames? Comment avec les dames? Aller avec les dames comme à Paris, ou rester avec les messieurs comme en Angleterre? Ah, madame. Vous me le demandez? Cries the little wretch, starting up in a theatrical way, and putting out his hand, which Mrs. Barry took, and with this the ladies left the room. Old Lady Pash trotted after her niece with her hand in ways, very much wondering at such practices, which were not in the least in vogue in the reign of George III. Mrs. Barry cast a glance of triumph at her husband, at the defection. And Barry was evidently annoyed that 3/8 of his male forces had left him. But fancy our delight and astonishment, when in a minute they all three came back again, the Frenchman looking entirely astonished, and the parson and the painter both very queer. The fact is, old downright Lady Pash, who had never been in Paris in her life before, and had no notion of being deprived of her usual hour's respite and nap, said at once to Mrs. Barry, My dear Angelica, you're surely not going to keep these three men here? Send them back to the dining room, for I've a thousand things to say to you. And Angelica, who expects to inherit her aunt's property, of course did as she was bid. On which the old lady fell into an easy chair, and fell asleep immediately, so soon, that is, as the shout caused by the reappearance of the three gentlemen in the dining room had subsided. I had meanwhile had some private conversation with little Cutler regarding the character of Mrs. Barry. He's a regular screw, whispered he, a regular tartar. Barry shows fight, though, sometimes, and I've known him have his own way for a week together. After dinner he is his own master, and hers when he has had his share of wine, and that's why she will never allow him to drink any. Was it a wicked, or was it a noble and honorable thought which came to us both at the same minute, to rescue Barry from his captivity? The ladies, of course, will give their verdict according to their gentle natures. But I know what men of courage will think, and by their jovial judgment will abide. We received, then, the three lost sheep back into our innocent fold again with the most joyous shouting and cheering. We made Barry, who was, in truth, nothing loth, order up I don't know how much more claret. We obliged the Frenchman to drink Malger Louis, and in the course of a short time we had poor Wei in such a state of excitement that he actually volunteered to sing a song, which he said he had heard at some very gay supper party at Cambridge, and which begins, "Pie sat on a pear tree, a pie sat on a pear tree, a pie sat on a pear tree, hey ho, hey ho, hey ho." Fancy Mrs. Berry's face as she looked in the midst of that bacchanalian ditty, when she saw no less a person than the Reverend Lemuel Wei caroling it. "Is it you, my dear?" cries Berry, as brave now as any Petruchio. "Come in, and sit down, and hear Wei's song." "Lady Pash is asleep, Frank," said she. "Well, darling, that's the very reason. Give Mrs. Berry a glass, Jack, will you? Would you wake your aunt, sir?" hissed out Madam. "Never mind me, love. I'm awake, and like it," cried the venerable Lady Pash from the salon. "In away, gentlemen." At which we all set up an audacious cheer, and Mrs. Berry flounced back to the drawing room, but did not leave the door open, that her aunt might hear our melodies. Berry had by this time arrived at that confidential state to which a third bottle always brings the well-regulated mind, and he made a clean confession to Cutler and myself of his numerous matrimonial annoyances. He was not allowed to dine out, he said, and but seldom to ask his friends to meet him at home. He never dared smoke a cigar for the life of him, not even in the stables. He spent the mornings dawdling in eternal shops, the evenings at endless tea parties, or in reading poems or missionary tracts to his wife. He was compelled to take physic whenever she thought he looked a little pale, to change his shoes and stockings whenever he came in from a walk. "Look here," said he, opening his chest and shaking his fist at Dobus, "look what Angelica and that infernal Dobus have brought me to. I thought it might be a flannel waistcoat into which Madam had forced him, but it was worse. I give you my word of honor it was a pitched plaster." We all roared at this, and the doctor as loud as anyone, but he vowed that he had no hand in the pitched plaster. It was a favorite family remedy of the late apothecary Sir George Coddicombe, and had been put on by Mrs. Berry's own fair hands. When Anatole came in with coffee, Berry was in such high courage that he told him to go to the deuce with it, and we never caught sight of Lady Pashmore, except when, muffled up to the nose, she passed through the salle manger to go to her carriage, in which Dobus and the parson were likewise to be transported to Paris. "E a man, Frank," says she, "and hold your own," for the good old lady had taken her nephew's part in the matrimonial business, "and you, Mr. Fitzboodle, come and see him often. You're a good fellow, take old one-eyed Calipash's word for it. Shall I take you to Paris?" Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.